everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We have been focusing on elders more and more, and we were just trying to clean up this with a with a little more information, and we brought into the studio an old friend of ours and yours, Dr. Bernard Starr, who's probably the single greatest authority on aging that I know in the world of psychology. Bernie, welcome back to WBAI.
Well, it's great being back with you, Armand. I'm thrilled to know that I'm the greatest authority. I doubt it, but I'm not going to argue with you.
All right. One of the less fewer authorities on... one of the least knowledgeable authorities, Bernie Starr.
Okay.
All right, make you feel better. There are some people you just can't say something good about because they're just going to take you right down. And Linda Vanilla is certainly with us. Bernie, thank you for being here, and I know it was the last minute. But there's an idea that we have here, which is going to be the bottom line concept, which is, I call elder power. That's where we're going to. But along the way, there are still many things that people who have written letters to us want to understand, and there are questions I'm going to ask you about. First of all, some of the comments that came back to me through both Facebook and online to my website, people would write letters and they would say, you know, seniors, it's so hard to get them going because most of them are depressed, that there's a senior depression that seems to automatically be there, and that... they're all living with their children. Let's get some real facts straight. Can you tell us about this, the stereotypes of what adulthood is?
Yes, well, as you well know, the stereotypes abound, and they're very difficult to challenge or counter. They're so ingrained in most people, the belief that older people are neuters, they're sexless, they're sick, they're depressed, they're needy. They keep their money in mattresses, they don't change brands, they don't buy things, and all of that is really bogus, and there's solid research to say much the contrary, but it's hard to get the message across.
Maybe you mean this is not opinion?
It's not opinion. Let's take the depression thing. People assume that older people are depressed. A lot of that is based on the fear of younger people of aging, so they jump to the conclusion and they assume that, well, if you're closer to your maker, you must be depressed. But research project after research project shows that the most depressed group are middle-aged people between 45 and 55, because that's probably where the greatest fear factor enters the picture, fear of aging.
So you would say that most people who are over 65, for example, the baby boomers and over 65, you would say most of them are not depressed.
Absolutely. All the research confirms that. And even the older group tends to... we're not talking about people who are, infirm or have catastrophic illnesses, but people, and this goes for the majority of older people, who are relatively healthy and independent, and by any measure, all the happiness indexes and whatnot, they score higher than other groups.
Well, what percentage of them are most people feel? You know, the old idea of the ideal Japanese model, which is that we will respect the elders in such a way that we will eventually give them such high regard. What percentage of elders live with family, for example, with their being taken care of? Now, the classic example is an elder whose mate dies, right? And now they're alone. Now you got a woman alone or a man alone. Usually it's a woman alone because the men seem to die sooner, unless that's a stereotype. But it seems to be that there are more women than men. Well, you said something about men who are elders, they, as soon as their mate dies, they remarry.
Yes,
right?
Well, all the statistics show that the men remarry. Within 2 years, most widowers remarry.
Okay, so now you have a lot of widows who are there, and they don't have anybody around.
Yes, that's why some of the leading experts in the field say that aging is a women's issue.
That's a kind of interesting concept. What do they mean by that?
Well, because three-quarters of all married women will be widows at some point in their lives. And their options and their choices are much limited. I mean, we could go into that, the sexism of society, the greater options of men, et cetera, but that's just simply a fact, that three-quarters of married women will be widows at some point in their lives for a number of reasons. They marry, the first, women are healthier by and large than men. They live longer than men, about six, it's narrowing, but about 6 years or so. And traditionally, that may be changing somewhat, women married men who were older than them.
So it kind of makes sense. The men are going to go first. Now, so let's say you got a mother, and most of the listeners have a parent who they're taking care of in one way or another, or are a parent being taken care of by their children. What right do you have as an adult to demand that your children take care of you? Because, you know, you kind of like, it reminds me of the model of Medicare. You know, it's like, hey, I got to this point.
Well, first, it's kind of a funny question because in the United States, the tradition is that older people don't, at least in modern times, maybe when we were an agricultural society and you had the extended family all living together, older people lived with their adult children. But the tradition in this country is for independence. I mean, that's the American way. And a very small percentage of elders in this country live with their adult children. I don't have the figure at the tip of my fingers today because you kind of just dragged me in here today. But I believe it's in the 10% or less range compared to other countries. You mentioned Japan. And up until fairly recently, maybe upwards of even 75% of older people lived with adult children. But that has changed dramatically. And our vision that if we embraced the Asian way, the respect for older people, that that would solve all of our problems of the aging society. Well, they're facing the same issues that we face here, the economic crunch, the independence of women, et cetera, et cetera.
If you're a parent, if you're a person who's married and you have children of your own, have you generally found that there's a, what's the effect of bringing a parent into your home to live with you when you're married? Do you think it's a positive or negative necessarily? What do you think? You mean you want to live with your in-law?
Well, that's
I mean, so many people who are married turn to their mates and say, look, my mother's alone. She's sick. I can't stand watching her being sick and alone. Let's bring her in the house. We'll get an extra room for her to live in.
Well, number one, first of all, many older people simply, it wouldn't be acceptable to them. I mean, we tend to look at it as a one-sided issue, that they have this burning desire to be taken care of, and they're eager to move in, and the adult children are not, question that or are not happy with that decision. But often the issue is a non-issue because the older people, by and large, don't want to live that way. As far as the issues and the problems.
Why not, Bernie? Why not?
Because we have a tradition of independence in this country. And, I mean, let's face it, historically, when we did have the extended family, and we often romanticized that, oh, if we only had the extended family where elders had a role and everybody was living together. But when you look closely, the fact is that the older widows, for example, they became the caretakers. They became the cooks. They became servants, in effect. And often that's what happens when older people, live in this extended family situation. As I say, we tend to over-romanticize it as if it's a great thing. They lose their independence. They can't date, for example. I mean, we have a different... Well, you read in the magazines. What is it? 50 is the new 30. 70 is the new 50.
So you also are accountable, you know, when you're an elder, let's say you're 70 years old, and you go to live with your kids who are in their 50s or in their late 40s, you're accountable to them. They see you all the time. It's a very different thing to suddenly feel accountable to somebody.
Well, exactly, and it has all of the problems of people living together in general. I think it was Ram Dass, you know, the great spiritual teacher, once said to some of his followers, said, if you think that you're enlightened and that you've achieved some kind of spiritual growth, he says, go home and spend 2 weeks with your family.
Why? What will that do?
Well, because all of the old issues come up. Many people complain about that. They may be successful business people. They may be successful in all aspects of their life. And often when they go back into the family situation, they revert to the earlier roles.
I just can't see how it could work. You know, if you're married and you're trying to form a love relationship with somebody and you're trying to bond, how do you possibly have your parents living in the house with you? How do you not wind up with split loyalties, triangulation, all that other stuff? You know, it's such a difficult situation.
Now, in some cases, that does happen, that adults move in with their children. But
give us a big enough space, give us a separate apartment, give us something maybe that might work. But it's very hard having your mate right there.
Yeah, but even so, a lot... In my mother's case, for example, she would never consider that. And I know other people, too, that as long as they could ambulate, get around, most people opt for independent living.
That's right. Your mom's still alive.
No, she isn't. But was a lively one.
She was a lively one till time
One of the
ago.
Few people that I ever met who was never depressed. I don't ever recall her. Unfortunately, those aren't the genes that I inherited. But and I once questioned her about it when she was in her 80s, and she didn't even have the concept of boredom. She said, "How could you be bored? There's so many things to do." So there are various individual differences, but at the same time, by and large, our culture promotes a great deal of independence, and particularly for older people, the whole notion of what it means to be older, and particularly as the baby boomers now cross the 65 marker, they're different than our grandparents, our parents, our grandparents, and certainly their image is not one of being taken care of.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Bernard Starr, who has written two books. One is on aging and sexuality. He was one of the first people to write about the sexuality of older adults. And then another book on psychotherapy and spirituality at Marymount College, and also a full professor and PhD, clinical psychologist. Bernie and I know each other for many, many years. And Bernie's got a perspective, something that was recently in the Huffington Post, that we're going to bring to you about the way that we could perhaps turn this around. But in the meantime, I want information. One of the bits of information that I got a lot of questions about was parents falling down, parents getting hurt, and how that relates to the potential of alcoholism in adults. Now, we did a little bit of programming on it about the hidden alcoholism. Why is drinking such a problem among older adults who live alone?
Well, one of the big problems with drinking in later life is that it's more easily concealed than when you're younger or middle-aged. When you're in the work world, for example, and you come in drunk or high on drugs, it's going to have repercussions. People will notice it. Could be the end of your career. Could create all kinds of financial problems, social problems, family problems, marital problems. When you're older, and particularly for those who are living alone, it's more easy to conceal it. And the symptoms of it are often confused because of the stereotypes that we have of older people, that the symptoms associated with drug addiction and with excessive alcohol use are seen as symptoms of just old age. Oh, the person is forgetful because he's old, the person falls down because he or she is old, and all of the other symptoms of drug and alcohol abuse.
And so you don't see it as much, as well as one of the things...
You may see it, but you may misinterpret it.
Right. And one of the things we discovered is it also takes much less alcohol to inebriate, an older adult, because it just goes through your system a lot.
Right. It's not metabolized.
It's not metabolized. Therefore, it's in your body. So you could be drunk and not know it. And then you have the problem of memory. So now you could be drunk and forget how much you drank.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'll work that way much more on adults than it would on average.
And then, of course, the interaction with drugs, since most older people are on a frightful number of prescription drugs. I mean, people over 80, for example, are on average, I think the number is somewhere like 8 different prescription drugs.
that they're taking.
That they're taking, plus over-the-counter drugs that their doctors may not even be aware of. And God knows what the interaction effects of that are. I once spoke to one of the leading experts on this, and we barely know the interaction effects of two drugs. When you get beyond that, it's a no man's land, and then you add alcohol to that and and other drugs. And if you had an atomic explosion there, you couldn't be too surprised.
Let's say you have an older adult, a parent, Bernie, who does drink, does fall down, and does tell you they don't. They deny it the whole way. And then, but you know this is true, and you confront them on it, and they say, no, it's not true, and they live alone, and you don't live there. What could you do?
Well, I think that first you need an overall assessment of what is really impacting their lives. And we know there's many reasons why people drink and take drugs, but some of the underlying factors may be depression, may be loneliness, may be the lack of social contacts. So you have to get an overall assessment of that.
You're 85 years old, your husband died, you're a little broken in your bones, and you're around your house and you watch Oprah and The View all day long, and a piece of you is saying, well, why not? I'll just drink and get the day passed, and then I'll start smoking cigarettes, almost as if you were trying to get death to happen sooner.
Well, that could very well be the case. And for many older people whose lives narrow because of physical and other limitations, it's a big turnaround in their lives. Some of the people you're talking about may have been very active, may have been very social, may have been very involved in lots of things, and suddenly, dramatically, their life changes due to physical ailments, the loss of a spouse, the loss of sexuality, the loss of physical contact with people. So the alcoholism and drug taking, it may be a response to that. So, like alcoholism in general, it's very difficult to address it directly head on, saying, oh, stop drinking, it's bad for you, and let's see if we can control your drinking, when you have all of these tsunamis that are erupting underneath it.
You know, and you can get arrested if you're a parent of a child and you neglect that child. But if you're a parent, if you're a person who neglects a parent, you feel guilty, but it's no crime. And many people I know just ignore the parents. They just ignore them. I mean, it's a choice that every person has as an adult. You know, either the person gets help or doesn't get help, and it's not your responsibility. But the tendency is to feel so responsible for that parent.
Yes, as we well know in all familial relationships, guilt is a co-pilot.
Gets you working, gets you going there. All right, Dr. Bernie, Linda Vanella is also here. Linda, is there anything you want to ask?
Well, yes, I'm aware of many seniors that are sort of locked into their homes, as you say, Bernie, and isolated. And I think that's a very big problem. So what would you say would be perhaps some of the innovative ways to get seniors to get out of that house and become more a part of the community?
Well, that's going to our punchline, which I guess we have to first introduce. All right, because that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the empowerment. And let's start with that, Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with your perspective, which I think is very important, Linda. We're going to get to that because that's the bottom question. What's your perspective about this adult? I mean, let's make some noise. Let's show the objectionable you.
Yeah, well, here you're talking about my other thesis that I wrote about in the Huffington Post. The article was titled "How Seniors Can Save American Education and the Economy," but the thesis that underlies that is a very simple one of arithmetic.
Let's do it.
That we have a growing elderly population; people are living longer. In 1900, average lifespan from birth was around age 50. Now it's in the highs, about 78, 79. We've added 50% to life expectancy, and it's going to increase, okay? So explaining why we have a growing elderly population. At the same time, we have a shrinking younger population, a decline in the birth rate. And yet, it's that younger population that has to, in terms of entitlements, support the older population. So it's a matter of simple arithmetic. growing elderly population, shrinking younger population, and shrinking workforce, productive workforce, high school dropout rate, people dropping out of college, college costs, college loans, etc. So how is this going to work? This is a vast revolution. And I have a very simple thesis that it can only work, that you can't have this huge elderly population that strictly is focusing on entitlements, although they deserved and they paid for Social Security. But at the same time, we have to develop some kind of system, if this is going to work, particularly projected into the future, where the disparity and the arithmetic that I'm citing will grow. We have to find some way in which older people can contribute to productivity in society, that they have to be active, participating, full-fledged members of society, and that we have to change our thinking about aging and how an aging society can work. I mean, that's my, in a nutshell, my thesis.
So what do we do with it?
Okay, so what are we going to do? How are we going to have older people contribute to the economy, or maybe applying what John F. Kennedy said, which we interpreted as applying to young people, has to be applied to older people now. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I think that one way, although I hardly have all the answers, I could state the problem, but one way is that I think that we need a vast system of volunteerism for people to give back, but the current system is flawed. That it's too elitist, it's too difficult to find these matches, that we need neighborhood centers where people on retirement, that every older person has to feel responsible to give something back, where you check into a storefront, a senior center, or somewhere, where you are counseled, matches are made, and you have to find and volunteer for some way of directly or indirectly contributing to productivity. It may be through mentoring young people, helping people who ordinarily wouldn't be productive without help, maybe restoring programs due to all the economic cutbacks in the schools. It may be, and again, this isn't elitist, so there's things for plumbers to do, electricians, other people to help improve the lives of people so they can become more productive members of society.
Bernie, you talk about this kind of expectancy. You know, I'm older now and you should take care of me, and what you're saying is true. There's not enough around to take care of you. There are older growing adults, right? We have 15% of the population roughly are now seniors, and that percentage is growing and growing, and the younger people are less and less.
Yes, exactly.
So now how can we expect that Medicare is going to be extended, right, for us to, that you're going to keep taking care of us and keep taking care of us? Tell me about college debt.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, we need a healthy and educated workforce that is ready for the 21st century technological society that we have. And we have a large college dropout rate. A large number don't complete college. And one of the things that to explain that is the cost. I mean, some of you listeners who are sending kids to college, or if you're in college yourself, you know what I'm talking about. $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. And student loans, $925 billion. You get that? $925 billion in outstanding student loan. You could check it out. Go to Google, find the student debt clock. Mark Hantrowitz set this up, and we add $100 billion a year to that. Now, that's going to take money away from the economy in the future. These people, if they can find jobs, they're going to have lower-paying jobs, and they're going to be saddled with this immense student debt. Where is the discretionary money going to come to feed this economy?
You're saying the elders owe it to us. Because I'm one of the elders, so it's okay.
Well, so am I.
So we can talk because
we would have to go into a witness protection program if we were talking this way 25 years ago.
We might still have to go into one, you know, Bernie, but it's true. You know, the elders owe a little. And if you're out there and you're one of those who are listening and saying, why don't they take care of me? Look, I've gotten through life. That's enough of that. You know, your life expectancy.
Well, but we could do that too. But I'm saying that part of the responsibility, we have to change the mentality about aging, that every older person has to feel a responsibility to give back. We talk gratuitously about the wisdom of old age. okay? But we have no way of harnessing that wisdom. Yes, there's a vast reservoir of skills out there, of talents, of abilities. We have artists, we have creative people, we have business people, and we don't harness this. We just talk about the wisdom of old age. But let's harness this now, and let's give some of it back and to help younger people become productive members of society, because that's the only way we're going to be able to support and pay for the aging society.
So it's there. And if you're one of us, and if you're a WBAI listener from the beginning, you're one of them.
Let me add one other thing. Sure, this, you'll be interested in this particularly, Armand, and that is, because of this narrow focus that we've had on just entitlements and how are we going to pay for it rather than looking at the whole picture, the demographers and the economists look at this arithmetic that I'm spelling out and they say, well, there's only one answer. People are going to have to work longer, okay? So we'll extend the work life. And then they go around and they interview people, but they always interview people in their 40s and maybe up to the late 50s or 60. And they say, well, you know, with the 401k's gone and the pension's gone and you have no savings, et cetera, how are you going to deal with retirement? And what did they say? I'm going to work till I drop. Well, and they, oh, yeah, the great idea. That's ducky. However, you ask people 60 about that, and the enthusiasm drops a little bit. You ask them at 65, which is when it counts, because that's when it impacts the entitlements, and there's even less enthusiasm. Ask them at 70, 75, and boom, it drops very dramatically. It's a bogus argument. Many people in their 70s and 80s, first of all, can't work because of disabilities they may have. And then it's an elitist idea. Yes, you and I may be able to work till we drop. We could sit here and talk on radio forever till they carry us out. College professors can, but if you're a long-haul truck driver, you know, you're going to be enthusiastic about continuing that job at 75 and 80. So that's a bogus argument, and you should be aware of that when you read in the papers and you hear these commentators say, oh, we've got the answer. They'll work till they drop.
Yeah, well, the other idea of it is, if you are a truck driver, you've got teaching to do. Now, you are part of a program, I know, which is harnessing some of this energy of elders as teachers.
Absolutely. That's a great idea. And that's exactly what I mean by the current structure of volunteerism is very elitist, because they're basically talking about professional people and people with advanced skills to give back, and they're not talking about the average Joe and Jane and what they have to give, and they have a lot to give.
So what Bernie Starr says, and what I may be saying as well, I'm not sure yet, but if he doesn't get killed, I'll probably say it. you just can't lay back. That's it. If you're walking around and you've got enough physical health that you could get out there and take care of some people and do some good in this world, you owe it. You owe it to a world who has taken you to where you are now. We don't owe it to you. You owe it to us. Well, actually, I owe it to you.
And that's a dangerous idea.
It's a dangerous idea. Why is it dangerous, Bernie?
Because everybody hates it. That's why when I've written about this, I get flack from the left and the right, because you're just supposed to take care of older people, and you're not allowed to make any demands on it. Even within the field, I go to all of the professional meetings of gerontology, the American Society of Aging, and the Gerontological Society, and whenever you've spoken about there's train wrecks ahead, there's a tsunami ahead, forecasting about the arithmetic that we're talking about, I've always gotten negative reactions from AARP and the professionals in the field. Shh, keep quiet. Don't even hint or suggest that there are problems with an aging society.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then more with this Dr. Bernard Starr, Linda Vanella, talking about the responsibility of the elders. We'll be right back.
Here it is your crown. and your seal and rings. Here is your love for all things.
Here is your cart, your cardboard and piss. And here is your love for all this. May everyone live. Everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye.
Here it is. Here it is. Here is your wine and your drunken ball. And here is your love for it all.
Your sickness, your bed and your pain. Here is your love for the woman, the man. May everyone live. May everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye.
The night has begun, and here is your death in the heart of your son.
And here is the dawn, till death do us part. And here is your death in your daughter's heart. May everyone live. Everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye.
And may everyone live. May everyone die.
Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye.
Leonard Cohen, of course. Here it is. Friends, a sad song, isn't it? But you know, that's part of what we deal with. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. If you just happened to pass us by and on the station, and if you're going through your dial, you said, what nice music. Who would be playing Leonard Cohen? Well, The Positive Mind here on WBAI has been with you for 20 years. And we have been, we've gone through a lot of incarnations. Incarnations, I like that. Incarnations. And we've been here in many different ways. Recently, we've been focusing our attention on the elders. Because it's come to our attention that there's a big problem out there and a growing problem and a misrepresentation, a lack of representation. So we've taken up the banner. I'm a lucky elder. I've got a purpose. I've got something to do. Bernie Starr, Linda Vanella, we may be considered elders, and but there's purpose here. You know, there's something we're doing. I don't have the feeling that you owe me. I have the feeling I owe you. Well, one of the things that seemed to happen with the elders is that we get this entitlement program, elder entitlements, which may have been good in the 50s. In the 50s, the entitlement programs may have made a lot of sense, retirement age. But now, who is entitled? Dr. Bernard Storr, revolutionary psychologist, guy who gets darts thrown at him by everybody because he's standing up there and he's saying, look, ladies and gentlemen, you're out there. You're not doing anything with your time except, you know, meeting to play bridge. Do something. Do something. Whatever it is, go do volunteer work. You owe it. It's not that we owe you. You owe us. Go work in a hospital. Go help out. I was in a hospital one day visiting a friend, and I saw an elder walking around as kind of a candy striper. He said, is there anything I could do for you? Is there anything I could get for you? Would you like a pillow? Would you like something? It was like beautiful to see, you know? So this is part of what the thesis here is today. Bernie, let's go back to it. Your idea of how we can be using the elders in an engaged way to give something back to our society and to help as well.
Okay, sure. First, I'd like to make a very important announcement here, first for this show and for BAI. Folks, the 1950s are over. Okay, they're over, and they're not coming back. Now, that's not a joke, because Armand just made reference to it, of how we're kind of stuck in that period, that we're swimming in nostalgia.
But the 70s and 80s will always be here.
But really, I mean, part of the problem of us relating and dealing with an aging society is that we're swimming in nostalgia, that we're drowning in the economics and sociology of the 1950s, when, as you pointed out, that a lot of the things made sense. Do you know, when Social Security was initiated, in 1935, that people started collecting in 1940, there were 50 workers for each retiree. Okay, we're down to somewhere about 3, less than 4, and we're heading to less than 2. And you know what all of the experts have said? No problem, because those 2 or 3 are higher wages and they're more productive. Huh? You see, part of the denial, 50 workers to support retirees. And by the way, nobody was expected to live very long, because they said...
Right, the life expectancy was about 70, 68, 69, anyway.
It was less than that, the life expectancy, so they set the entitlements to kick in at 65, and very few people were supposed to collect it. But it didn't quite work out that way, okay? So we have a different world today. And since everything else has changed, why should everything that was in place at that time remain the same? When FDR signed that Social Security Act, and these are his exact words, because I've actually played them when I did a radio spot on this, he says, this Social Security Act is to prevent poverty in old age. Now, he could not have anticipated, because it was the height of the Depression, 25% of the population unemployed, older people, no chance possibly of ever working again. He could not have anticipated that many decades later, last year, for example, a million millionaires collected Social Security benefits. Okay. Now, I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't get it. They paid into it. But that he couldn't have possibly thought about that. I heard Jack Welch recently at the 92nd Street Y giving a talk about the future. You know, he was the CEO of GE for many years. And he said, in his vision about the future of America, he said, why am I collecting Social Security? He said, that's crazy. And I've heard this from some other people, too. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that we take it away from them. The other day, I saw...
But how many people, you know...
That's a figure. A million millionaires collecting.
Now, so you got to figure, a million millionaires are collecting this check that they maybe not necessarily need. How many do you think would sign it over? I mean, refusing it may be one thing, but signing it over would be such a thing to do. You know what I mean?
It's a great idea, and I'm sure Jack Welch and other people donate so much money that, in effect, they are doing that.
In effect, does it. Right?
But what about other people? Great idea. Maybe there should be some tax benefit for that if you give it to education of the needy. you assign yourself. So, so you may be onto something there.
So maybe not a monetary benefit, but how about a benefit to your soul? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there is something about, I'm going to go from dole to soul. You know, and it's something about feeling like you're on the dole, which is feeling like you're an adult who's waiting to be taken care of by everybody, and they owe you Medicare and the doctor. Well, you got to wait for the doctor because the doctor takes your Medicare, but you're eight people in the waiting room, and because you're only a Medicare person as opposed to a pay-as-you-go person. And you begin feeling like you're just one of these few people who get little breadcrumbs thrown at them occasionally because you feel like a recipient. You feel like, What do you got for me? Oh, can I wait in the line for you? Oh, can I, you know, I've got time. Mm-hmm. I've got all the time in the world, you know, so please. Mm-hmm. As opposed to being that kind of person, as opposed to being a person who's proactive, who is saying, I'm given, so I deserve. Now, giving, you talked about free college. Let's talk about that as an idea.
Okay, but just to follow up one thought, because when push comes to shove, as it will with the arithmetic of the growing elderly population, shrinking younger population, et cetera, all of these questions are going to be raised. And just one other example, I was in the subway the other day, and I saw a guy with an attaché case, a briefcase, clearly heading, you know, coiffed perfectly. He was heading down to Wall Street, and he's using his senior discount on the subway. Now, why are we seniors getting a discount on that when a 40-year-old with two children and unemployed has to pay full fare? Okay, and I think, again, when push comes to shove, these questions are going to be at the forefront, and I think that we have to really rethink an aging society and an equitable distribution of wealth, and particularly the need to nurture and support young people, because that's the way you support an aging society. And that leads into my other proposal, which I may have to leave town on, and that is free college education. We talked before about the crippling cost of college, the astonishing outstanding student debt of $925 billion and growing $100 billion a year. Well, the initial reaction to that is, you know, that's crazy. How can we have free college education? Let me remind you of one thing, though. We did have free college education. I mean, you're familiar with that, aren't
you? Sure.
We've had free college. In fact, I went to Brooklyn College. It was $5 a semester. I remember when they raised it to 10.
Absolutely.
People were screaming.
Absolutely.
Jonas Salk went to City College, and he said once in an interview that he came from such a poor family that if there were any tuition at all, he wouldn't have been able to go, and that most days he came to school with half a sandwich because that's all he could afford. And he gave us the Salk polio vaccine that saved millions and millions of lives. Okay, and by the way, and we had free education in this country at the height of the Great Depression. So on the one hand, we say, "Oh, that's impossible."
Are you saying, Bernie, that there is no longer any free education? Isn't there city colleges? Aren't they free?
No.
Nothing's free.
No, there's no free college education.
There's no free education.
And they're raising the tuitions. Students in California were rioting recently because they raised the rate. We have free college? So the concept itself, in principle, has some historical precedent. How come we were able to have free college education during the Great Depression, and now we're crying, oh, we can't do that, when it's absolutely necessary for our survival economically in the future? Okay, what I'm proposing is initially for those who can't afford college, because we're getting 30% dropout rate in the first year of college, and eventually 40% don't graduate. That's going to hurt us as a productive society later on. We can provide free college education using volunteer retired professors delivering the curriculum over interactive technologies like Skype.
Ooh.
Now this is
Hold on a second. Now that's kind of what a concept. Using older people who have got a lot of knowledge, right? So we get somebody like Bill Gates, over 65 yet?
Well, he's getting there.
He's getting there, right? You get somebody like that who says, all right, now I'm going to be a productive member of society. I'm going to get on Skype, and I'll have a class. I'll have a class over the internet with students who could sign up? Well, there's certainly colleges that do that now, right?
Well, they're doing it at colleges, so it's not such a far-fetched idea.
No, it isn't at all.
Because what they figured out is, why have 200 students in a lecture hall with a professor reading his old notes when you could give that same lecture and deliver it via Skype, and students could listen to it any watch at any time. They could do it from their dorms. They could do it from anywhere. So it's being done, and it's not necessarily an inferior education. As a matter of fact, some experts in higher education said that that's where all education will be in the future, that it will be considered medieval to have.
Actually go to a school is going to become...
It's medieval. I mean, in medieval times, before the printing press, the teacher had the only book. He was essentially reading the book, and the students were there taking notes. They were scribes. But that's ridiculous in this technological world we live in. Okay, now, another example of why it's doable. I was executive director, and I'm still involved in developing much of the program for something called, here in New York City, the Center for Learning and Living. We started and ran it for 16 years at Marymount Manhattan College, and it's a program for retirees, 55 and older, but the model could work at any level. And it was based on the premise that we would have volunteer teachers. Okay, so we would have a very low fee, because Marymount had to get something out of it, that the students would have to pay. And the initial reaction was, well, who's going to teach for nothing, free? Well, lo and behold, we ran an ad in the Times and in community newspapers. We had world-class teachers in the program. I'll give an example. Charles Carshon, he was the head of the theater department at Sarah Lawrence for 35 years. He taught acting at Stella Adler's school. Some of the greatest actors have said they attributed their real learning about acting from Charles Carshon. We've had other world-class teachers from universities. They give one course. They're happy to do it, okay? And they would be particularly happy to do it in what I'm proposing for free college, because it would be a significant contribution to the success of America in the 21st century.
And that's not the only reason. The other reason, it makes you feel vital to be a teacher. It makes you feel like you're doing something.
Absolutely.
It makes you feel necessary.
And that's
like
what
you have
they
a
all
purpose,
say.
You know? Mm-hmm. You're not going to be put out on the ice. You know, like they just float away. You now got a thing you do.
And the beauty of this is that these volunteer professors, and all we need is for these volunteers to do one course, because there are so many of them out there, that we can have a full curriculum. And these courses, delivered via the present technologies like Skype, can be done from anywhere. So we're not restricting or constricting their leisure time. Many of them would be happy to do it.
Stomp your stuff to State Street Ramblers.
Hey, Michael, I can hear your mic is open. Uh-huh, go ahead.
Yeah, but this can be delivered from anywhere. You could do it from your retirement home in Sun City. You could do it from your yacht floating around the Mediterranean, or you could do it in your one-bedroom apartment, wherever you might be. It's doable. Or you could do it in these centers that I mentioned earlier, where all seniors would volunteer. And you could have volunteer technical people to make sure that the technology works. Okay, so all of this is doable if we are committed to it, and if we change our mentality about what aging is all about, what the responsibilities of aging are, the ethic of giving back, the ethic of nurturing the young, the philosophy that you can only have a successful aging society and secure older people if you have secure younger people. And younger people who are educated and healthy.
Well, you know, Bernie, it certainly is radical thinking, but the right kind of radical thinking. By the way, what are the initials TAFWU stand
for? Oh, that's
for?
The name of my proposed university called Third Age Wisdom University.
You know, it's a funny thing. We get a
Third Age Free. Third Age Free Wisdom University, TAFWU.
TAFWU.
And by the way, you could even get... corporations because I think they have a responsibility here to contribute space for these neighborhood centers. And when I investigated this, I found out that there are corporations that are already doing this. For example, the Crown America Corporation that owns a mall in Pennsylvania, when they set up this mall in the 1970s, they allocated a very big space there for the community to use. Boscov's department stores gives free spaces for community programs and services. And Wachovia Bank donates space to a senior program, a lifelong learning program in Hilton Head. So it's doable.
We're at that point. We see enough of it here at WBAI because we do these fund drives, marathon fund drives, every few weeks, it seems. And one of the things that we have, a very important part of WBAI, is its volunteer corps. And we get a number of people who come and volunteer to come in. They can't contribute to the station, but they could answer the phones.
And what I would like to ask your listeners, Armand, is if we did have this simple, accessible system where you could go into a neighborhood location, speak to a humanoid who could counsel you, shepherd you into something that was meaningful and productive, would you be willing to do it?
Well, I guess how would we find out what they have to say about that?
Well, they'll send a contribution in the name of this to BAI.
And WBAI, by the way, we're going into next week. We'll be in the fund drive, which will be for the rest of the month of July. And during that time, our programming will be changed. If you're a regular listener of The Positive Mind on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, next week you have to tune in at 2 o'clock as opposed to 1 o'clock because we're altering our schedule to adapt. We'd like to see whatever you could do, especially if you could be a volunteer and come down to the station and help out in any way. But I'd also like to receive emails that I'll pass on to Bernie Starr, Dr. Bernard Starr. Bernie, they could look at your website and your Facebook because you got a lot of information on that. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, they could email me at longevity@AOL.com, or I do have a fledgling website that I just set up called Bernard Starr at bernardstarr@bernardstarr.com. And if you want to learn more about this TAFWU, the free education, I do have there's a YouTube presentation that I have on this. I was interviewed on it by Rita Zatz, a former producer at WNBC Television News. So if you go to YouTube and type in my name you could just type in my name. The name of the piece is How Seniors Can Save American Education and the Economy.
Nice going, Bernie. Thank you so much for being back here, and I'm sure we're going to be revisiting with you again. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Hey. So we're calling for action, and we're calling for action in a different kind of way. We're asking those of you who are the senior members, who feel, you know, like they're useless and have nothing to do, there's a lot to do, and we need your help. And if you're somebody who's caring for a senior, don't just sit there and feel sorry for them. Tell them they owe it to us. You tell them, you say to your mother or father, listen, get out of that chair. Come with me, we're going somewhere where I want to see you talk to somebody who's lonely. Come on, let's see you give us what you have, and you're going to spread it around the world. Even if I put you in the park and you do nothing but smile, share your beauty with the world, I refuse to be a part of your just sitting there any longer. This is Armand DeMille, I'll be back with you Tuesday at 2 p.m. I want to thank you again, Bernie. If you want to send me an email, or if you want to take a shot at me, it's Armand@thepositivemind.com. Armand@thepositivemind.com. Bye-bye, my friends.